Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when we have to remind you out there in the listening audience, whether you're listening here in the Central Coast of California or out across America, that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And of course, we're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs, who believe in what we're doing, to help us stay on the air. And we're not only on the air here in the evening, as you know, we're on the Internet, we're on the shortwave. We do programs on the weekends on the major stations all up and down the Pacific Coast. We have 8 outlets in New York State at the present time. So we are getting out. Our message is being heard. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, for a suggested gift of $20 or more, or whatever you feel is proper, why, of course, we'll get you the 4 best tapes of the month. We'll get you the monthly newsletter. And let me tell you, I think our monthly newsletter is unique among all newsletters because, of course, we will take you into the background of the history of how we got to where we are today and the spiritual forces that are at work. And, of course, unless we address the spiritual forces, we're going to continue to be totally ineffective in this battle. So if you agree with our message and would like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. You can write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. That's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. If you're listening to this program out in the Midwest, there's going to be a meeting in St. Louis from the, I think it's the 9th to the 11th, the 9th to the 12th. It's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of that week. Henry Lamb is going to put that on, and I'm going to be there. Phyllis Schlafly and Phil Crane, and I shouldn't say Phil Crane, I should say Ron Paul or one of his assistants, Alan Keyes. Looks like a great program, and I'd like to suggest maybe you'd like to come and have an opportunity. I hope that we're going to learn a lot, and I hope we'll be able to come up with some ideas how we can be more effective in getting the information out. And then I want to tell you that people all across the country are setting up little study clubs in their homes, in their neighborhoods, in their churches, utilizing our information, our videos, our tapes, to educate people about the true nature of the battle we're involved in. So if you'd like to become involved with us, why, give us a call. We'd be glad to send you the information. We have a 10-point program on how you begin to approach what's going on. And, of course, we'd love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, if you're out there in the listening audience and if you'd like to talk to Mr. Stinnett, our guest this evening, Robert B. Stinnett, and he's written a fascinating book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And, of course, the telephone number here is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'd be glad to take your call. Now, how can people get hold of your book if they'd like to get one?
The copies of the book are available at all all good bookstores, and you can get it on the internet, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and all major bookstores.
All right, fine. And of course, it will give you a tremendous amount of information on the background. Anybody ever talked to Commander McCullough about this directive, where he really laid out the plan to force the Japanese to attack the United States?
No, because you see that memorandum was kept secret. So he never testified about that before any of the congressional investigations and did not reveal it at any time.
Well, of course, the question is, did Franklin Delano Roosevelt actually see this 8-point program to provoke the Japanese into attacking us?
That is one of the questions that I am asked, but there is no direct proof that he saw the memo, but he placed all of the 8 actions in force. with executive orders or by his own direct orders to the naval commanders. So that's very strong circumstantial evidence.
I really believe, I don't think there's any question at all that he did see it, but of course everything has been an effort to conceal the truth, and it was not to conceal the truth from the Japanese, it was to conceal the truth from the American public. And I know that very well in the elections that followed that in 1944, Thomas Dewey was going to be running for the presidency, and he was told it would be unpatriotic to raise any question that FDR had been involved in precipitating and setting up Pearl Harbor. And then, of course, the same thing again in 1948 when he ran against Harry Truman, and he was just told, you mustn't bring this up after all. We don't want the American people to lose confidence in the government. But, of course, I think the American people need to learn the truth, because if you don't understand what happened before, we're going to see similar instances in the future. What sort of response are you getting as you're going around the country talking to people about this?
Well, I have about a 70% approval rating all throughout the country, no matter where I go. That's with the news media, reviews of the book, and comments by readers to Amazon.com, comments on the Internet. There's about 30% of the people that just don't accept these Navy records as evidence. They don't have any really answer to it. There's one professor in Hawaii says that there's no such thing as the classical seamounts in north of Hawaii. This is where the Japanese launched their attack. But the professor, if he looked at a nautical map, they clearly show these are named after the classical composers. And that's where Japan launched it, from the Prokofiev seamount.
All right. Now, of course, there were a number of things about the various codes that you go into. Would you like to cover that at all in the discussion? Because there was not just one code, but there were a number of different codes that had broken, weren't there?
Yes. Your listeners should know that we're talking about the Japanese foreign ministry codes and the Japanese Navy codes. And the foreign ministry codes were fully discussed in the congressional investigation of 1945-46, but not the Navy codes. And these are the ones that really have the secrets. And those are still very difficult to come by. So we had broken this Navy code starting in 1940. Japan changed it, but then we were intercepting their Navy code messages, and we had broken their codes, even though they changed it, and we could translate the messages right up to the attack.
What was the WINS message that we hear about?
Oh, the WINS message was a hidden word code issued by the Japanese Foreign Ministry. See, each of the Japanese ministries, the Navy, Army, and Foreign Ministry, had a hidden word code because some of their stations didn't have cryptographers. So they used a hidden word code. And the ministries, this was the signal of the start of the war. So the Foreign Ministry said East Wind Rain meant that the war would start. And East Wind Rain was the code meaning the United States, which was east of Japan, would be involved in the war. The Japanese Navy code, the hidden word code, was climb Mount Niitaka, December the 8th. Mount Niitaka is the highest mountain in the Japanese Empire. The Japanese Army's hidden code was the black kite and eagle will fly December the 8th.
Now, of course, then we were just monitoring everything that they had, but then we were also tracking the course of this fleet, and you point out that there were 128 intercepts there over a period of about a week as they tracked the Japanese fleet into the North Pacific. And yet there are people out there who say, oh, there was the Japanese were using radio silence, so that's why we lost contact with the fleet. And they're still trying to push this idea we didn't know where the fleet was, because if we knew where the fleet was, then, of course, we should have told Admiral Kimmel.
Well, that is right. And this radio silence doctrine is just receive momentum from right after the end of the war, but that's just not true. We had 25 monitoring stations in the Pacific, this included United States, Britain, and the Netherlands and Canada. And these monitoring stations included radio direction finders all throughout the rim, from the west coast of the United States to Asia. And when these Japanese ships went on the air, then they were immediately recognized as warships, and we obtained their position both in the North Pacific and in the Central Pacific.
And, of course, that, of course, is one of the cruxes of this whole thing. They keep insisting that there was radio silence, and you actually were able to track down all of, or many of these intercepts, weren't you?
That's right. The intercepts and the radio operator logs show that we were intercepting the Japanese fleet. There's just no question about it. They were intercepting about in Hawaii alone, they were intercepting about 1,000 messages every 24 hours. That's a staggering amount. From July 15th, 1941, when this operation really started, this monitoring operation, to December 6th, there was close to 300,000 messages were intercepted from the Japanese fleet. But, you know, only 1% of those have been released by our government. By 1%, I mean about 2,200. And all the rest are still locked up in vaults. I am trying to get them, and I believe that eventually I will get them. But that's a staggering amount of concealment.
Well, of course, but everything has to be concealed, concealed, concealed. If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to talk to Mr. Stinnett, our telephone number here, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. This is a very distressing book. It's distressing when you think that 2,800 boys went down. In fact, if you've ever been to Pearl Harbor, and you'll actually see just the top of the Arizona sticking up out of the water there. And, of course, there many of them are still interred there, and they never got their bodies out. And, of course, this is a permanent tribute to a day of infamy. But, of course, the infamy was not the infamy that President Roosevelt talked about. He talked about this as a day of infamy, but, of course, it did not reflect on the Japanese. It reflected on President Roosevelt, who had already created a situation where the Japanese had no alternative but to attack, and that, of course, he had left the perfect trap for them. Our telephone number, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Now, do you get at all into those various tragic investigations where Admiral Kimmel and General Short were repeatedly, required to come and sort of defend their position and at least try to get the truth out about what had happened?
Well, that is right. Admiral Kimmel and General Short did try to get the Navy to turn over these very crucial documents, but the Navy wouldn't even admit that they existed. And Admiral Kimmel, of course, was never told about them. So he didn't really know the full extent of our interception activities there in Hawaii.
Well, I would think that this would be a very demoralizing thing for our military to realize the background of what really happened. Do you think that that's why, after 50, almost 60 years, they're still concealing the information?
Well, of course, there's many in the United States Navy and the Army who thought that this was the, quote, right thing to do to overcome the isolation movement. And as you said earlier in the program, the head cryptographer, the Navy's head cryptographer in Hawaii, said this was a cheap price to pay. He was referring to the attack for the unification of America.
And I think that is such a disgusting statement. And it would be all right, you know, if he had died or his son had died, and then he could say that, but it was other people's sons who died, and
well,
he didn't suffer from it.
That is correct. That's, you know, not my backyard type. We all hear it's all right for somebody else to get killed, but not me.
Right. And, of course, the tragedy is this is the attitude of many of these elitists who have a different world vision than we do. Now, you've got an awful lot of documents here, and you actually show this document from Colonel McCollum, Commander McCollum, where he actually lays out these points, how we were going to trap the Japanese into attacking. And I think this is really fascinating. As you say, this is the smoking gun which nobody has ever seen before.
Well, that is right, and your listeners should know that Commander McCollum was born in Japan to Baptist ministry parents. He was born in Nagasaki, Japan, and lived there, learned Japanese before he learned English, and played with Japanese children, and learned culture, and that sort of thing. And he was there in Japan when Japan... fought the, I think it was the Russian fleet in the Korean waters in 1904 on a surprise attack. So he knew the Japanese propensity for a surprise attack. And so he eventually became a naval officer. He went to the Naval Academy, graduated, and was sent to Japan on one of his first tours, where he was assigned to the U.S. Embassy. And he even instructed Crown Prince Hirohito, the future emperor, on the jazz age dance rhythms and that sort of thing. So he had a huge and knowledgeable background of Japan.
Right. Didn't he teach him the Charleston?
That's right, right, right.
But, of course, then he turned around and really betrayed the Japanese. There must have been some other way to work this out rather than such a cold and brutal and bloody war. Because, of course, this take a tremendous toll on Japan as well as on the United States.
Well, that is right. Here again, you know, the end justifies the means, and the whole idea was to get at Adolf Hitler, who our military leaders felt was the real danger, not Japan.
All right, fine. Well, of course, there's just so much information here in this book, going into the background of all the various things that actually happened. What part did Vice Admiral King play in this whole issue?
Well, the Admiral King was the Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Fleet, and he seems to be in a shadowy figure here all throughout 1941. He's meeting with President Roosevelt at Hyde Park in the woods of the President's estate. He's meeting with the President in the Oval Office in odd hours, and then he seems to be groomed to take over the United States Navy once this attack at Hawaii was successful, and that's what happened. Admiral Stark, who was the Chief of Naval Operations, was fired by Roosevelt in late December 41, and Admiral King took over. But it's interesting to note that Admiral King started selected his flagship to be based in Washington in early November 1941, so he knew that this was going to happen.
And, of course, nobody liked Admiral King, did they?
He was a tough tough admiral. He went by the book.
Okay, we've got Ron calling from Washington State. Hi, Ron. How you doing?
Yeah, Dr. Stan, I've listened to your program quite a bit. I got a question for you.
Okay, go for it.
I'm up here by Everett Naval Air Station here.
Right.
And I'm an ex-military man myself, 27 and a half years in the military. And after listening to this interview with a book about what happened at Pearl Harbor, you know, it makes me really feel bad, especially when you see a lot of these guys on a license plate with, sorry.
I know how you feel. Have you ever heard our four tapes out on the men we left behind or the one man came back? If you have a chance, get those four tape sets, because I know you love America, you fought for America, you believe in America. But you need to understand that there are very, really dark spiritual forces at work. We've got two forces in America. One is the force of good, Judeo-Christian concepts, and the other is the force of evil. And sometimes those forces of evil take over because the good people aren't involved. And the reason I do what I do 3 hours a day is to try to make people understand and really motivate them to get involved in this battle, which is a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield.
Right. Well, I listen to your program just about every day since I found you on the in the Internet.
Well, God bless you for that. And
I'll tell you what, I look forward to listening to you because you're really getting the truth out there. It's very important for these people.
Well, that's what we're doing. And please tell others, get them listening on the Internet. And, of course, they can... unfortunately, we don't have any short wave out there, right? The short wave primarily in the eastern part. But we do have a program in Portland, so it gets into the southern part of Washington, but not up where you are.
Right, right.
Okay, well, look, thanks so very much.
Well,
any other question or comment?
I see a lot of these guys with on a license plate. I'm a Pearl Harbor veteran, and it makes me really feel bad.
Yeah, I know. God bless you. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, our telephone number, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you have a question or comment on this fascinating book entitled The Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor by Robert B. Stinnett. It's available at bookstores across America, probably at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. And it's a book that you need to read because, of course, as you read this, you see time and time again the barriers that were put in the way of Mr. Stinnett as he's trying to get the information. In fact, on one of the documents that you got, didn't they cut off the bottom of that or something? What was that story about?
Yes, the documents, the Navy documents originating in Pearl Harbor that had the radio direction finder bearings of the Japanese warships, these were all cut off from the bottom of the reports that went to Admiral Kimmel. So I discovered these when I asked for these documents, and they were given to me, but there was a whole bottom part containing the radio direction finder bearings were missing. And there was, and the archivists at the National Archives, I asked them about it. What happened to them? They said that's the way they were received at National Archives from the Navy vaults.
Well, you know, I almost had a feeling that there were people there in Pearl Harbor were actually involved in this whole thing and keeping the information from Admiral Kimmel and General Short. Certainly, you pointed out earlier that their intelligence officers were withholding the information that they needed to know that the attack was imminent.
Yes, that's correct. You know, that original aid action memo was addressed by Commander McCollum to his boss, who was head of Naval Intelligence. And that he was Captain Walter Anderson. Well, President Roosevelt appointed Captain Anderson to be commander of battleships of the Pacific Fleet. And so Captain Anderson was promoted to rear admiral, sent to Hawaii as the number three person under Admiral Kimmel. And so Admiral Anderson was the gatekeeper there in Hawaii to, since he had all his background in naval intelligence, he appointed the intelligence officers there in Hawaii.
And they were the ones who kept the information from poor Admiral Kimmel.
That's right.
And, of course, you know, as you get into the background of this whole incredible story, it's really quite unbelievable. I had the opportunity of going to the Sterling Library at the Yale University, and there they have Secretary of War Stimson's diary. And I have a copy of it upstairs in my files, where he said, you know, the only question was how we were going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot, because there was a tremendous isolationist attitude. I mean, after the First World War, people said, why did we go to the war in the first place? It wasn't our war. What did we accomplish? We lost, you know, 100,000 men and a couple of 100,000 casualties. And, you know, all we did was really prolong the First World War for another year and a half. We want to stay out of this war in Europe. And that was the attitude of the average American. We don't want to get into this war. But there were people who were really determined that we were going to get into it. In fact, didn't President Roosevelt do a lot of things that really were designed to antagonize Adolf Hitler, like giving some 50 ships to destroyers to Adolf Hitler and providing supplies, a tremendous amount of supplies to the British under the name of Lend-Lease?
Yes, you're correct about that. And that did antagonize Adolf Hitler, and his submarines were sinking our ships in the North Atlantic, including warships. But that did not arouse the American public for some strange reason. They just didn't want to get into the European wars, is what the isolation movement slogan was.
Well, of course, they realized the First World War was a phony war. I mean, how do you justify the First World War? If you read what the Germans wrote, the Germans kept trying to get peace. In fact, the German Kaiser never understood the war. You read his memoirs, he couldn't understand what it was all about. And I think there were a lot of Americans who had that sense of total frustration. Do we really want to get into another war? And, of course, many of them perhaps felt that this was a contrived war, just exactly as the First World War had been. Of course, after the war, if you've read any of the writings of Charles Beard, he was a great historian at that time, and he said, you know, that the great foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, and certainly the people of great wealth were doing everything they could to prevent any histories from being written that would tend to differ with the official party line. You know, that Adolf Hitler was about ready to attack America, and that's why we had to get into the battle. And Charles Beard wrote and said, you know, they have an organized effort to block any rewriting of history. In other words, to tell the people a different line, or perhaps the truth about what happened, differing with that of the official government historians.
Well, you're correct. The American parents just didn't want to send their boys to fight in another European war. Totally against that. 80% of American people didn't want anything to do with that European war.
And then after Pearl Harbor, why, it switched right
Absolutely.
Back.
Absolutely. It was a instant unification, and young men flocked to the recruiting agencies for the Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps.
Okay, fine. Well, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're out there across America listening to us, or here in the Central Coast of California, give us a call. And if you agree, you disagree, that's what talk radio is all about, and we'll give you an opportunity to give us a call. Again, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest this evening, Mr. Robert B. Stivett, his book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Well, you know, as you go into the background of this, and you talk about this being a cover-up, most people are going to say, why, this would have to be a terribly large cover-up. I mean, how could you cover up anything of this magnitude for so many years? Obviously, there couldn't be a cover-up. There's no way with this many people involved in this that this could have happened the way you say.
Yes, well, you're right. People do say that. But, you see, it was easy to control this information because as communications intelligence, only about a handful of people really had access to these documents, and they were immediately after the attack on December 7th, they were locked up in Navy vaults, as I said earlier. But that's still many people were suspicious of this, the president's actions. And immediately after the war ended in September 1945, Life magazine printed pretty much the story of it, that it was provoked. But that was seen as an anti-Roosevelt tirade by Henry Luce, who was the publisher of Life magazine. So in the euphoria of the victory, it just didn't get anywhere.
Well, it's a great, great tragedy. We'll be back in just a moment at Radio Liberty.